Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 10th, 1999, and in the fireside room we have Joel Oinas as the presenter, and his session will be entitled Creation and Domination, or not Domination, but Dominion. And this is OIJ 99-3.
And then as it goes backwards, it begins to get fuller, and so its brilliance is about the same all the time. And I've only seen it once, and it was a wonderful day where I and the way to see the planets is just buy an astronomy magazine, and they will tell you where they are, and that simplifies it a whole lot. And it's only a $3 investment for a whole month, and they don't move that fast, so you can kind of keep track of it. You only have to buy one or two a year. But there was a night where they said Mercury. Mercury is just a smaller version of Venus. Venus is huge and you can't mistake it. It's the brightest object in the sky next to the moon and the sun. But inside, remember, we're in this big orbital plane and the sun is out there in the evening. Venus goes like this. Mercury is like this, very close to the sun. And it is never seen in a black sky. You have to get it in the twilight. And it's just, you know, there's an orange band, and then there's a lighter blue, and then a dark blue. Right where it almost turns to midnight blue is where it is at its apogee there. And there was one day where I was in my yard and looking. The sun had just gone down. I knew where the sun was because you could still sort of see the light on the horizon. And there was Mercury, this tiny dot. It was the magazine said it would be the only object you can see between Venus and the horizon. And so I looked out there and, you know, got the binoculars and sort of went back and forth, and there it was. And then I could see it with my naked eye. And there, Mercury was there. And Venus was there. Mars was there. And Saturn was there. And so here, and the moon was a crescent someplace. It would be a crescent back here. So here I was, standing in my own yard. I knew where the sun was: Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Saturn, and our own moon. And it was a spiritual experience to realize that the eyes that God has given me was able to perceive the infinitesimally small light from the only rocks in the vicinity. And it was all reflected light from the sun that had just disappeared. It was worth the. I mean, it's sort of an odd. Astronomy has all sorts of odd devotees, but once you're hooked, you sort of stay hooked. Any comments so far? Some of you are new, so I'll bring you up to date. This has been really fun for me. I have been starting out with prayer, so let's do that again. Creator God, we have for so long thought of ourselves as the only actors on the stage that you've created. But we know now, maybe too late, and with a growing humility, that our brothers and sisters, the other creatures, are not only yours and beloved by you, but our forces and companions that we need. We ask that you would give us a clearer sense of our place in this world. In Christ's name, amen. Well, in the first session, we contrasted faith with science. And I drew a picture on the board. We talked about the theologians and the people that are safeguarding faith are obligated to create sort of a framework, a house, that describes the important features, our nature, our purpose, you know, how all things fit together, have a natural theology, and ideas and principles about God and about human beings and about sin, about what the church is. We have to have this framework. And where science emerged as a form of knowledge that builds one block at a time. And the conflict came that science was laying foundations or uncovering footings that that weren't symmetrical with the house that theology had built. And so we talked about that. And we also talked about that faith is prone to love its theology more than its truth. That the framework becomes more important than what is the house actually will be like, or that reality is really like. And science, the one thing that I've learned from science, it teaches us the discipline of doubt, which I think, and this may be another conversation sometime, is more akin to both the New Testament and the Lutheran understanding of faith. That doubt is what prepares us for a reliance on a greater God. And so that was our first discussion. Session two, we did some manual geometry outside, and we actually touched on calculus. You need to know this. We just flirted with it a little bit, because we did velocity, and velocity is a rate, and a rate is when you take a unit. We were doing distance. The change in distance divided by the change in time. Any rate is a derivative, and it is one of the essential elements of the calculus, which solves problems that change over time. That's the difference between algebra and calculus, the simple difference. Algebra does static problems. Calculus was invented to solve problems that exist over time. And you can, you know, with all that whirling stuff, you need it. And velocity is like one of the first steps you take when you're learning physics. And in college, they sort of start teaching you calculus at the same time. So you did flirt with a little calculus, so you could be proud of yourself. So. We talked about the big distances. And we did that to cast a bit of doubt on our cosmological certainty, both as Christians and as scientifically educated but not scientist moderns. And we talked about our place in creation, and I mentioned our vocation as the proper way to look at that creation story. And last night's Vespers were wonderful in reminding me and reminding everyone that a vocation can only exist when you know who's in charge and who has made the world and who has an intention behind it. And that is what produces the vocation. Once you acknowledge that God, not Babylon, not any other more modern superpower, is in control, then the vocation emerges. Okay. And today we need to talk again about arrogance, as we considered after the cosmos, the community of creation, all the flora, the fauna, and the role in that community of creation of that mostly naked mammal with the big brain and the powerful hands. That's us. And one of the most peculiar, and here we get to one of the most peculiar features of Christianity's theological house, was its failure to observe that nature changes. We've been living with that for a long time. But the theological house we talked about from the Middle Ages on to our modern time was invested in the fact that nature was eternal and unchanging. It had easily built into the framework, you know, that human destiny, our future, our activity, our creativity, our being made in the image of God, allowed for change there. But it required a stage that was sort of inert. And we spent enormous energy accounting for all the changes and improvements we made in our station. But it never noticed or acknowledged. In fact, it's a fundamental assumption that the nature or the environment, the word even indicates what it is, it's what's not us out there, environment, was a stage, a permanent stage, was set for our drama, and it did not, it could not change. Now, the story that we read last night does have certain elements of unchangeability about it, and it's the Hebrew concern with made these people after their kind, you know, made these animals and these plants with seed after their kind. This is a result of priestly, well, some would say priestly silliness, but it's an orderliness that was part of the Hebrew way of thinking. And it was a very important one. I mean, out of this orderliness came all the belief that certain things were unclean because they were dirty or because they were too holy. And to keep things in their proper place was part of the Hebrew ethic. I'm not sure I understand it all, but this is why you didn't make cloth out of two different threads. That's why, I mean, it's why sheep and goats didn't interbreed. That there were kinds and there's sort of a suggestion that that's the way it is and was and always will be. And I think that was just sort of not looked at very carefully and just assumed. And it was built into the theological house. But the cracks began to appear when. In this theological house, I mean, it was a long time developing, but there was 1,000 years, maybe the Middle Ages, where it was just elaborated upon, and more trim was put on, and you know, more curtains were hung, and it was unchallenged for a long time. And it was when Galileo picked up that telescope that he looked through it, and he saw there are three things that he reports. He turned his telescope on Saturn. And with our naked eye, it looks like a disc. If you have real sharp eyes, it looks like a star that doesn't twinkle. But he turned his telescope on, and this telescope is not as powerful as binoculars you can buy for $60. And he turned it on there, and he saw a round thing, but he saw two little things like cup handles on the side of it. Like it had ears, and he even writes this down. He got this telescope, and then he's sort of a semi-professional. He's they didn't have professors and tenure back then. He's sort of working between an appointment in Pisa, but the better appointment is over in Venice and Padua. So he's sort of writing letters, trying to get in these places. And in order to keep his credentials up, he has to be inventing things and writing things and showing that he's right on top of science. And so he frantically gets this, and it's real competitive. There are other people that have telescopes. He's not the first one. But he has these enormous powers of observation, and he sees this, and he writes it down. He even draws a picture of it. And he has this very accurate picture of a circle and these two ears. Didn't know what it was. Didn't know for a long time that it was actually, he was looking at the rings of Saturn tilted, and they looked like little ears, but he drew the picture of it. And then he turned his telescope on Jupiter, and he has a day-by-day account of these little stars that he first saw. There's four stars that line up with Jupiter. The next day he came back, they were like this on either side of Jupiter. The next day he came back, they were like this. And he draws a little picture of this and say, and what he had discovered, and contrary to the celestial room in the theological house, that this planet had planets. And then he turned his eye on the moon and saw craters, saw gouges and gashes in it. And his observation, he got on the part of the moon that was half day, half night. And it was there he reasoned that he could see the shadows best. And he watched as the sun, he would do this for hours. And he would watch the sun as the moon turned in its rotation. He saw the mountains. He would see a little white thing appear, and what it was a mountaintop. He would see a little spot appear, and slowly it would grow bigger, and then the shadow would appear. And he reasoned just with this little weak telescope that it was covered with moon, that it had topology on it. It had imperfections. And when he wrote about that, he unleashed an unintended challenge to the part of the theological house that was concerned with heaven. And that essentially said, heaven is perfect. Out of our reach, those are spheres up there. They move in perfectly circular orbits. There are no blemishes or imperfections. And he had just seen three of them in a week's time. And it was an unsettling challenge. And it was the most serious. It was the most serious challenge to date to the theological house. Well, and it was interesting how quickly all the Italian all the scientists were connected with the church. Lots of them were Jesuits from the New Order and other monks that had a lot of time on their hands and were just fascinated by these discoveries. They all started making their own telescopes. Galileo had a shop, and he started grinding his own lenses and hired another person, trying to keep ahead of the demand. But this was not received very well by the people in charge of the theological house. Pope Paul the Fifth and his little cadre of Jesuit scientists. But while they were debating whether even to look through a telescope was a sin, the generals from northern Italy came and said, we think this might be useful. Mm-hmm. And so you can see right there, it's a symbolic of the trouble the church is in while science becomes very chummy with those that need technology and don't care how they get it, as long as it does the job. Well, and it wasn't until, I think it's 91 or 94, the Catholic Church actually dealt with their forced abjuration of Galileo. It was just within the last 10 years that, and I'll tell you, I have not been able to find it yet. Maybe one of you professors could dig it up. But I searched the internet, and there were a lot of people that were sympathetic with Galileo. There are Galileo web pages, the scientists that crucify the church daily on the internet. But there was very little on the Vatican page. Couldn't find it there. But it was a conversation that did not say, we're sorry Galileo was right, but just acknowledged that the church may have been extreme in its reaction. This is within the last 10 years. Most of the world acquiesced, and certainly the other astronomical scientists pursued that very eagerly. But that's in the heavens. And even though it attacked a very important part of the theological house, it left the earth and the physical world untouched. And there was still a wing in the theological house that says, nature is unchanging. We still have the earth. You know, even though there might be perfections out there, we can still manage the theological house. And this is still something that we can depend on. And of course, the challenge to the constancy of the earth came from Charles Darwin. And we immediately think of Darwin as the one who has made us descended from apes. We're still fighting that battle in some small circles. But the challenge to the theological house was much bigger. If you want a date on this, just say somewhere between, I'll just put 1850. Saying too many dates is really depressing. But he started as a geologist around 1830s. In the 1830s, the Beagle went out to skirted South America. And he published sometime close to 1860, maybe 1859 or somewhere. But just remember 1850. And he started as a geologist. And he was of a school that was out discovering all sorts of indications that the world had been changing. And his trip around, he was not a naturalist, he was not a biologist, but he did collect samples, and he relied on others in England to help him interpret it. But he became very skilled at that. But he went originally as a geologist, and he would climb the Andes Mountains. The ship would pull into some little port, and he would hire a horse and some residents, and he would go up into the mountains as far as he could. And he found seashells, he found beach sand, clear up in the Andes. And he's saying there had to be a process that lifted this out of the sea and up. The voyage, like I said, was one to collect specimens, and I think it was 3 years long. He was in his 20s. And finally, he came back, and the scientific world was really struggling to make this. They were very excited about this sort of stuff. And they were all working together, and there were fierce conversations about the constancy of nature or whether change was occurring. And after years of working on his information and working with others and sitting on it for at least a decade, knowing that that there would be enormous theological problems with his ideas, he sat on his book for a decade, and then finally, right around 1860, published The Origin of Species. And what he said, that knocked the whole wing of the Orthodox house down, was that nature changed and has always been changing and will continue to change. It's not a static given. It's not a stage for human. And the worst thing that he said, of course, was that acknowledging our undeniable similarity to the rest of the creatures, we probably originated in the same way. And he said in the book there were two mechanisms. One is that there was this sort of social competition. It was nothing that we were aware of or consciously did, but variations occurred in people. There were always variations occurring. And somehow, certain random variations gave certain individuals an advantage. And their advantage showed up in the population because they were able to breed more successfully. And their offspring were more numerous. And so what happened was the advantageous variations produce more of their kind, and those with the less advantageous variations were not as successful. And so the population began to change and go in this direction. That was the large mechanism. But biology soon realized that there was a cause for the variations. There was somehow that the variations, you know, took place. And biologists got extremely excited about it, and they were off and running. The race was on to find the source of those biological variations. And as you know, we're still in that race today with the human genome and all the research and the data that's carried in the DNA. But although biology thought it was the best day that had ever happened to them, remember the politics at the time. All this fed into the emerging theories of the godless Democrats in England. And there's the royals who, by birth, you know, this unchanging class ruled. And there were the Whigs who were saying, no, every individual is worth the same as another individual. And can you imagine how this talk of the survival of the fittest affected that political realm? These were dangerous. You know, the blooded aristocracy reeled as the force of democracy brandished this new weapon, the survival of the fittest. And the political literature of the day is very scared. And, of course, the faith. They're left standing in the dust of their shattered natural theology. You know, no longer do they have the stage to work at. And so what they did, of course, and we all know it, is in another selfish act, the church abandon the whole rest of the creation to the evolutionary theory. Got in the lifeboat, boarded themselves up in the anthropological wing of the house, and said, we, nevertheless, are made by God. So it was really a cowardly thing to do, to say, well, you can have the animals. You know, take them, but leave us our divine origin. And I think that's just a little bit like this whole idea of, this is an aside, this whole idea of the constancy of nature is also a little bit of laziness. Like the inerrancy of scripture I mentioned yesterday. You know, you don't have to really get up from your desk if you have an inerrant text here. And it's true. If you have a nature that doesn't change, well, you can just close the door to that wing and work somewhere else. But, and if you take down the wing of the plants and animals, you just get into your anthropological wing, you know, the little closet, and stay there. And, you know, fight the last battle. Anyway, that was the last stand. And the rest of the world decided nature absolutely did change. And the church has been coping with that. And there was evidence everywhere. You know, people pointed back and said, well, look at, we've been raising cattle and selectively breeding cattle and sheep and dogs for years and years and years. Just the same, the mechanism is the same. And they talked about closely related species, and they started examining, instead of just cataloging biological creatures, they started comparing them for common origins, you know, looking at their history. And they found hand bones in the fins of cetaceans. You know, dolphins have hand bones and feet bones. And you know, their tails go different. Mammals in the ocean, their tails go like this. It's like feet like this, you know. Fish have tails that go up and down. That was a real sort of aha moment in grade school for me. I learned to draw them right. So the evidence was, you know, seafloors found on the plain. I live in a place that was seafloor for 500,000 years ago, and 350,000 years ago, you can see the shells there still. And why? In the middle of Wisconsin, you know, 2,000 miles. You know, the evidence was there. And people began to think of the crust of the earth as dynamic and say, well, it's been changing. And they started searching around for, and right about the turn of the century, somebody sort of foolishly suggested that the crust itself might move around in plates. And they didn't take it seriously for a long time, but the evidence was there. In all disciplines, science grew from a study of mere descriptions to include a history. That there is, things were like this here, they have changed, and the change in anticipating the change. And to look for change in a being and predict the future, and talk about it in terms of time. And there was, in about this time, about the turn of the century, a new science emerged called ecology. It started very small and has been sort of developing slowly. But looking at ecology essentially means the study of the house, or the study of our home. And it's looking at the whole community and how changes are caused and absorbed by all the members of the community. But during this time, and we're talking about from 1860 to maybe the turn of the century, maybe 1920, biology, animal biology, and geology had no marketable ideas. And they were regarded as dangerous to society. The politics were dangerous, survival of the fittest. And we'll talk tomorrow about some of the political ramifications of this. But the biological ideas and the geological ideas were dangerous and had, and I think part of it is because they really didn't have any marketable value. Now, on the other hand, physics was having a heyday. And the big thing about physics' chummy relationship with the culture and the economic system was that its laws were eternal. They're always the same. Gravity has worked the same since the beginning. And so physics was making discoveries in magnetism and electricity and mechanical inventions. And I think it's probably true with chemistry. And they had a very chummy, this is the Industrial Revolution, is chemistry and physics, the hard sciences. And while biologists were working furtively, sort of as culture's pariah, the physicists had their day, and the chemists. But the biologists, eventually, you know, as the church found other ways to sort of protect their house and, you know, began working on other structures, biologists and earth scientists began to notice disturbing signs of unhealthy change. They began to ask the question, well, why are all these bones of extinct animals around? What happened to them? They began to notice extinctions in their own time. The buffalo came pretty close to being extinct. And the naturalists on the plains reported that. And the romantic public in the East wondered about this manifest destiny. There's a monument not far from my home. It's a bronze plaque put up I'm not sure when it was put up, but it commemorates the shooting of the last passenger pigeon in the United States. It's right on a bluff that overlooks the confluence of the Wisconsin River and the Mississippi River. It's an odd place for it, but somebody, you know, it was beginning to be noticed. Then geological history began to notice that, after making the assumption and realizing that things change, you know, look at the history of the Earth and noticed how the whole Mediterranean basin had suffered from severe erosion. Looking back on the stories about grain being raised, endless grain fields in Libya, in northern Egypt, that the forests in Greece, beginning to put that history together and knowing that all the topsoil in the civilized world had kind of washed off into the Mediterranean. And the lands are beautiful, picturesque, but very worn out. In my own section of Wisconsin, the soil scientists have documented that two-thirds of the topsoil in my county is gone. And that's topsoil that blew in after the glacier. It was not anything that was there. Most of it had been washed down to bare rock. And this topsoil, when the glaciers retreated, blew in, covered the hills of my area, and now two-thirds of it is gone due to farming practices. And my own experience with this, there was a time when physics and chemistry had given this sort of can-do attitude. We can manage the earth. We can improve things. We can make the world better. We can manage this changing world. And chemists did it with plastics, fertilizer, pesticides. And my father, who grew up as sort of a Neolithic hunter fisher in northern Norway. I mean, he's as close to the Stone Age as he can come. It's still in this century. And he lived on a little island north of the Arctic Circle, and at seven, he and his family came to Wisconsin in 1929, just in time for the crash. And they farmed there. And my dad grew up in poverty, and the GI Bill paid for college, and he was always been interested in the land and agriculture. And he was courted and recruited by a large petrochemical company, Swift & Company. And that was the day when chemical fertilizers were the answer to poverty. They were the answer to everything. That productivity would bring the world out of its poverty and make everybody wealthy. And it was, everybody believed in it. And I sold a bill of goods like my dad sold a bill of goods. And he has later in his life, he has come to see the optimism was unfounded. But I remember the day that the story of Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, and that was in, what, 59 or 61? Somewhere when I was a young child. And the news reported that essentially our wonderful physical science and technology was maybe harming the plants. And the evidence was thin eggshells in birds. And she documented birds in the orchard. She was a naturalist of some skill and a good writer. And I have never read the book. But I remember the feeling in our household that this person, not only, it wasn't talked about like she didn't know what she was talking about, but it was a betrayal of our whole direction. The betrayal of our confidence in being able to solve and manage things. She was a traitor. And it was slowly that our family has struggled with this since. And but that was my experience of it. And my first immediate reaction was, this cannot be happening. It cannot be true. Anybody else have that sort of experience, or not all of you are old enough to remember Rachel Carson? Some of you are.
Mm-hmm. I can remember when my dad started fertilizing things. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a big deal.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
I mean, just.
Yeah. And my dad was.
It's going to change things.
Yeah, it did.
It did change things. And that farm is just about done.
And I think we all know sort of the history from that point, that more and more evidence has been piling up that not only does the earth change, but that we human beings are, with our big brains and our powerful hands and our theological sort of arrogance, have been changing the earth as well. And we, I think, we're at a wonderfully promising situation now where science has sort of lost its confidence in managing the world with the advent of large computers and very fast processing. A new science using those things has developed, and it's model making, chaos theory, the study of the butterfly effect, what computers can do that human beings can't do, and is now they can study several variables at once. It was always, before it was always, you had to limit the number of variables that you could look at, because a change in one variable, if you're looking at three of them, could change all the others, and it's very impossible to calculate the consequences. And these larger and faster computers with their cathode ray tube displays, and you look at it in television immediately, you didn't have to read cards, and look at printouts, could create models of climate, of population change, all sorts. You put in five or six variables and run it for a million years in the period of a week. And what they found was that a very slight variation in the variables, things that they would ignore in the previous arrangement, made huge differences. And no one knew this better than the ecologists, who are trying to manage all these variables at once. And in our time, science has become far less optimistic about managing the future. I think there's still a popular culture out there that science and technology will change things for us and will solve all our problems. But I don't think scientists believe that anymore. And so they're at the stage where they realize a certain kind of restraint and a conservatism in management, and that management is not going to be better than what was there originally. That there are some intricate structures in the way things are without us that should be known and learned and maybe left alone without our management. So that's a wonderful sort of a humble attitude for science. And at the same time, the church, standing there in the ruins of its natural theology, beginning to think about rebuilding. You know, it's been long enough now. And we're recognizing that there is something in our story about stewardship, that dominion and kiboshing may not mean what we thought it meant. That what we failed to see was that although we came on the stage last and took the bow before the story ended, there are all sorts of other creatures there, and we're not the director. We're not the manager of the story. We're not the owner of the theater. And so the church and science are both at this place of sort of humility and starting in their work. The church of rebuilding its natural theology, its theology, first article theology, theology of creation, and science, and sort of retrenching and saying, we can't go on like we were before. Now, we're about 20 minutes from 11:45. And what I'd like to do now is give you a chance. What I want to do first is to say that in this process there was lots of blame. And we recognize that human beings had the capacity to destroy the earth. There was lots of blame. But assigning blame is also, in a way, can be discovering the origin of the problem. And if you discover origin of the problem in that process, then you might find a way to the solution. And so this is the way the blame has gone. The Christians were sort of irrelevant to this whole thing until Lynn White in, I think, the 70s, wrote an article. He was a scientist that said, the Christian religion is to blame for our environmental crisis. So this is number one. Christian church is to blame because it said, fill the earth, subdue it, have dominion, and that's the problem. Ever since that was written, Judeo-Christian people of means have done that. They've ignored the sacredness of the earth and have used it as inanimate resources and have led us to where we are today. It was a shock, the church. It was like somebody snuck up behind the church in their little closet and slingshotted them through the window. So that's number one. And scientists were surprised to hear people saying the fault really lies with Western science and its failure to direct its discoveries to good purposes. It started when Galileo sold that telescope to the general who could see his opposition better. And science has never questioned those who pay for its services. So there's people who blame science. And said, who has been in charge the last 500 years? It's not the church. Look at our natural theology house. It's a wreck. It's the scientists that caused the problem. That's number two. And then, there's a little they had responses that sort of congealed in this response. And said, well, it's not the scientists. Scientists seek only truth. And the theologians would say, we're concerned with revelation in relation to God. It's you greedy and consumptive masses, you consumers, that demand all this stuff and are out of control in your acquisitiveness and your arrogance. It's the fault of human beings in general and the economic esperance in the community. You're a creature out of control. So that's number three. And then there's the other reaction. What damage? You know, what is natural. And human beings are a creature, and what they do is what they're made to do. So there's the four kind of blame assigned. We're still sorting that out. So one, Christianity is to blame for dominion. Two, science is to blame for its neutrality on ethics. Three, it's us who just are born to exploit. And four, it's no problem. It'll work out. So, you got any opinions on which one is accurate or how we should weigh those?
Well, the common element is the not me.
Not me.
Not me, yes. Not my fault. Yeah. Or not my job.
Not my job. but then, yeah, and then closely related and not my own backyard.
Okay, the NIMBY. Mm-hmm. Yes. Any insights into that?
Well, I was thinking about, I must fit in the sciences to blame one because earlier, just before you switched into this thing, that's the point I was going to make. You were talking about how scientists have been chastened and have discovered that, in fact, maybe they can't predict everything, and they're becoming more humble and acknowledging the sort of interdependence of Earth's ecological systems. And I think that's true as I think of the scientists that I know at Luther. On the other hand, there are the applied scientists, the ones that take the theory and put it into action and use it in technology. And I would say that the people that you were sort of suggesting that we've reached a point where we realize that a technological fix isn't really going to fix our problems. And I'm not so sure that's as true as I would like to believe it is. And I think there are a lot of people in the world that have a lot at stake in perpetuating our illusion that technology can solve all of these problems, because there's a lot of money to be made from that technology. And that kind of comes back to the acquisitive side, it then joins the science with the problem is our acquisitive nature. The Marxists might say, of course, that it's the capitalists that are to blame. But, of course, if we take a look at the former Soviet Union,
it's a mess.
In the aftermath, the reality is they were just as devastating as we are. But I guess all I'm trying to say here is that I wouldn't overestimate that we've learned the lesson that technology can't solve our problems.
Okay. So you're saying we shouldn't be optimistic?
No, I'm just
that's not as wonderful.
Don't be too optimistic about it.
Okay. Well, now you should say something about some of the things you do that give you that insight, because you are in touch with discussions on world population all the time, right?
Yeah, I mean my research interest is in population and population policy and ethics, but the place where I see the technology stuff coming up the most is in dealing with environmental problems. We've gone through that period of trying to use technology to solve fertility issues, and we've realized after 20 or 30 years that while technology is very important, you need to have good contraception. Ultimately, you can flood a community with rubbers, but that doesn't necessarily bring the fertility rate down. And that it's population policy is a much broader issue, more holistic approaches is necessary. So, but it's really only in environmental areas as opposed to that sort of, I see the technology thing still being.
People still saying we can fix it.
Ex machina, the thing that will come in and save us. Yeah.
But what really drives technology? What drives the development of technology?
Well, the technologists, in order to sort of come out clean, will say it's demand.
Wants and needs.
Okay. Well, what people want.
The technology in this country, most of the technological research in this country now is done by corporations. At one time it was done by universities and people, but now, in the last 30, 40 years, corporations have the money, they can move a lot faster, they can shift from this to this to something a university can't do. They got to submit budgets for years in advance, or a year in advance. A corporation can change in 1 week and
they're very changed.
So they do the, and these big corporations that you read about, these mergers and all that, the board of directors, that when they sit around, they don't talk about solving mankind's problems, and they don't talk about, they talk about technology. In other words, how can technology and our research help us to make more money? All they talk about is the purpose of corporations is to make money. It's not to please people or to solve mankind's problems or to do anything else.
And those companies are huge, international. They're very flexible, and they use math. They do. Their use of sophisticated sampling and population and estimates and statistics is that's where the calculus math majors end up. And your question, if I can take that and ask it again, do the economic interests tell us what we want, or do we tell them what we want?
They tell us.
Well, it's a come and go. It's a cycle. But the corporation, in its search for money, puts out products and that. And if they sell, they really that's what they build. And if they doesn't sell, well, of course they go build something else. But they can move pretty fast.
If they search for needs they can meet and manufacture quite a few along the way.
Well, I think it's a combination of things, both market research and then selling that on something too.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a way, I was just going to comment that in taking that attitude of the large corporations, it's in a way saying that's not me too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of absolving us from, I think consumers maybe do drive the market, and I do believe that. And whether it's false advertising, or we buy into something we really don't want, but I do think it does come back to that.
Yeah, Joel, I mean, I guess an example of just technology and something done for technology, perhaps, was we put somebody on the moon a long, long time ago. That was really cool. We got a lot of neat things out of that whole process. We've never gone back. Why don't we go back? There's no reason to. I mean, the people aren't saying, yeah, let's go back and collect some more rocks. We're not going. We did it. It was great. But we're not doing it again.
You have to stop and think, why did we go there in the first place? It's because John F. Kennedy said, let's go to the moon by the end of the decade. And that's why they went. He didn't have any reason why we should be there, except at the time they didn't want the Russians to...
So it was the proof of point that we could be there.
It was a result of the Cold War with Russia.
There you go. It seems that now that the military necessities for space warfare are sort of gone, the budgets are slashed.
Can I play devil's advocate and argue the... technological point of view?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, right. There's a lot of good things that you just barely touched on that, but there are some cool things that came out of the space race, the competition with the Soviets, things like semiconductors. You know, I really like our microwave. How many people here have a microwave in their home?
How many have a digital clock?
Those clocks that you can buy now, digital clocks, what do they cost? Like $1.49?
I've
there's a little semiconductor in there. I mean, you can throw them away when the battery dies and you can buy another one. You know, how many of us don't have one of those?
And it's given us an extraordinary scientific leg up in everything we do. I mean, Holden Village would be lost without the cloud. I mean, there's the bell. But who decides when my session is over, right? We all have this democratic technical wonder that tells us when we do things.
But you know, it's kind of strange. You mentioned the microwave. I don't know how familiar you are with what makes a microwave work, but the microwave was a direct result of research from World War II. It was, if it hadn't been for World War II, the microwave wouldn't have come along for a long time.
Yes,
because it's a radar generator in there, you know. So,
well, the question then emerges: if it's sort of a combination, if industry is there waiting, and spots needs that we may, you know, there's sort of incipient needs that it exploits, and we also can direct those by our consumption patterns. What's the responsible way to sort of use our power as individuals to affect this enormous, large-scaled technological juggernaut that seems unresponsive to the individual?
Well, that's where I was trying to get at yesterday in maybe Charlie's session or somebody's, I forget where it was, but just saying that a lot of this depends on what your view is of human vocation. What is the metaphor that drives your image of what it means to have a vocation as a creature of God? And I think we have two creation accounts that are juxtaposed with each other that give differing views of what it means to exercise human vocation. The one is a regal view. It's the priests wishing they were the kings of the world. And one where you have dominion over others, you can subdue it. You are the apex, the crown of creation. Right? The other is not a very regal image. It's one of a steward or of a gardener who's made from the earth and who will return to the earth as dust, whose partner in life is a helpmate to till the garden. It may be that it's time to quit reading Genesis 1 for a while and read Genesis 2 and read all of Genesis 2 and 3. And to allow to discover the lesson of humility, you know, humility, humus, that has to teach that our notion of human vocation, the paradigm of human vocation, the metaphor that we use needs to be guided by that, and that may help at least Christian scientists and Christian theologians to think about how to conceive of human vocation and these sorts of questions about what to do about science and technology.
Let me just put in a plug a second, Sandy. That's the subject for tomorrow. Now, I'm not saying
you have to keep coming back.
And it's the anthropology and
I'm going to be a marketing guy.
Thank you.
Be back for the next episode.
Yeah, Sandy.
Some of the things that we do are related to what we learn. And my world is when I was doing chemotherapy in an outpatient setting, I had to have a hood to protect me from the fumes as I prepared the medication. For every patient that came in there, you can't even imagine how many syringes that I twisted off a plastic top and a container for it and put it in a garbage and would end up every day with a huge bag of medical disposable stuff. And because of the fact that we know that if we also bring infection to the person, you know, and it goes on and on and on, we have the red plastic bags for biohazard stuff, and it just in one little setting, the waste of it was incredible, but was all for a very good purpose. I don't know how you get around some of that.
I think if we had to pick and choose and only were allowed a few technological advances, that's the one we settle on, not only for us, but for the one we were to share with the world. Mm-hmm. Oh, that healthcare would be it. I went through a treatment and a bone marrow transplant. And I wouldn't be here today if the technology wasn't there. And I can't speak very authentically against the importance of that.
I was just gonna say the techne means means. That's what it means in Greek. And the question is, what's the end? And that's ultimately the question. What is the end? What is the purpose? Why are we here? And that's why I keep coming back to the human vocation thing. And the most disturbing thing that I think I've encountered in my education with Larry Rasmussen at Union is his thesis that market capitalism is eroding our visions of the end. That the market capitalism and its and the way that it prizes the pursuit of individual freedoms and the pursuit of self-interest and says that if we all pursue our self-interest, that will magically through the invisible hand lift everybody up. Mm-hmm. That market capitalism is that those values of self-interest and the pursuit of material gain are driving out other values. Those are legitimate values. It's legitimate to have a concern about your self-interest. It's legitimate to improve the material standard of living of your life. Those are legitimate things to strive for. But his thesis is that that market capitalism is starting to crowd out other values like generosity or equality or democracy or psychological well-being,
sufficiency, or contentment.
Right, yeah. And that's that's ultimately. I think we can go around and around on the technology mm-hmm. thing, but ultimately it's about the ends to which you apply.
He makes this wonderful statement that the book Earth, Ethic, Earth, Community, and it's a scientific thing. He says that the democratic capitalism they're the only people that still believe in a flat Earth. He says because they don't believe there are limits. The dome. At least the firmament had a limit in Genesis 1. The garden was circumscribed, and this planet, remarkably has the same symmetry. It's limited. There's only so many square feet there. But those who insist on growth, even sustainable growth, are really assuming that we can go on forever, that the Earth is flat. Scientific medievalism.
I've been wondering, it feels kind of like a control issue, all of it, that it's so scary to think I don't have control.
And that you're trying to clung to this, what motivates us for self-interest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fear, so you're saying fear is one of the motivators for self-interest. Mm-hmm. Okay? I think that's good. Yeah.
Again, taking the non-popular point of view.
Good.
I think the corporations would respond to your statement about the limitless flat earth point of view, that really the name of the game is increases in productivity, thus the introduction of current chemical
fertilizers. Yeah, that's quite a bit harder to argue against.
Yeah. But really, kind of information technology. The idea is we're going to all be much more productive to drive down costs.
Right. I mean, this is $19.
Sure.
40 years ago, it filled a room. Sure. That's a very good demonstration of that point. Maybe in 100 years, everything we ever need for anything. Like the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. We'll all be here. Don't panic on that one. Thank you for this.
So technology is really to help us in our pursuit of our own self-interest and our legitimate rights to a better life. And so much technology, if you really get right down to it, it's to give us more free time for things for ourselves. And even advances in medicine are there, I think, are done to relieve from us the pain, whether or not it's the pain of somebody close dying because of a disease. I mean, you know, in nature, Ernest Thompson Seton wrote a series of short stories about animals, and every one of them, he says in the preface, every one of them ends a tragedy, because that's nature. That's the way it is. And so technology is driven, I think, by us, because we want our lives easier. We want more free time for our own pleasure pursuits. We don't want the pain of being hurt or seeing but somebody hurt. And if you really want to go deep, it's just like, what should we really be pursuing? Is pain and death an acceptable part? Is that something we need to live with?
It's what we value, pain? And it's what we fear. The questions are, what do we value, what do we fear?
Yeah, fear is really what drives the essentialness of medicine. But, you know, fear and death is what pain and death are what we fear. I wonder what Jesus would say about that.
It's hard.
What we do here on this world's not important. It's where we go. It's the next life.
But when you get down to having it be your grandson with a need for a major heart surgery, why are you ever glad that technology is there? But I was going to say too, Tom, about even the technology that you work with in terms of fighting fires. And that's for a very good purpose, to save the forest or save people from the fire.
But I guess in the big picture, people dying of fires.
Okay.
You know, I mean.
Yeah, all right.
Fires start naturally, and right. I heard you say not 2 or 3 days ago that we kind of upset things with our firefighting. Sure. You know, for 10,000 years, the fires burn that generate the forest.
And you see, this we're talking continually about a crisis in vocation. What are we supposed to be doing? And it's kind of all in turmoil, you know, saving people. And yet you end up with a bag of unrecyclable, dangerous refuse every day. Farmers thought they were feeding the world, and all of a sudden people are saying, the most destructive piece of technology is the moldboard plow. You know, they're stunned. They have been stunned and on the defensive ever since. Forest fires.
Right.
They've discovered that they've tried to make a human scale, a human needs park, and have nearly destroyed the forest by doing so. We have a crisis of vocation here in our material world.
Because we've tried to make a world separate from our world.
And all the indigenous people and the sort of hand-to-mouthers that we admire for their simplicity, they don't want to be there anymore. You know, 5 billion people in the world want to be like
us.
And I think that makes our discussion of what our vocation is very urgent. And I don't think anybody's in a better position than the church, if we just stop arguing about it. Other things, other pieces of the fallen down house.
So we're going to talk more about that tomorrow?
Yeah, tomorrow. And this is the introduction. It's about anthropology, and Tolstoy said it, and it's still true. But you think about it. Science does not teach us how to live. So we'll start there tomorrow. Maybe we'll have the trial. I promised you a trial by the animals, and maybe we'll start off with that tomorrow. So pick an animal or a plant, extinct, you know, dependent on humans, and we will have them pronounce some sort of opinion and judgment on the human animal tomorrow.